The clerk will call the docket.
Equal Investors Limited Partnership at Allen against Alamo Place EAAC. Allen to London, Brian Glasser, the accountant, Jason C. Hicks, Paul Catlin, the accountant.
You may come forward. The clerk will not start to talk until I tell them to. In this case, we're hearing a motion, and as a result, it is the appellee's motion, and you will go first. All right?
May it please the court, my name is Jason Hicks, and I represent Albemarle Place. The issue presented here today on Albemarle Place's motion to dismiss is not one of first impression. Appellant's petition for appeal is invalid under Rule 1A:4 because it was not signed by appellant's local Virginia council. Appellants admit their petition is invalid and now seek leave to file an amended petition after the mandatory and jurisdictional deadline has passed. Under Virginia law, however, this appeal should be dismissed and appellant's motion should be denied. First, appellants did not file a valid petition within the mandatory deadline. So there is no jurisdiction for this court to hear the appeal or grant motion. Since appellants cannot amend the petition because an amendment presupposes that there was a valid instrument to begin with, and under Rule 1A:4, the petition was invalid and a nullity. Thus, there is nothing to amend. Third, even if an amendment were possible, the amendment would not relate back to the original filing date. Therefore, appellant's proposed amendment is untimely. This is not the first time that the court has addressed these issues. There are at least four recent Supreme Court of Virginia cases directly on point. In each of those cases, the court held that a filing not signed by local Virginia counsel was invalid and did not permit an amendment after the deadline had expired. In the Wellmore Coal Corporation case, this court dismissed an appeal when the notice of appeal was signed by out-of-state attorney and was not signed by local Virginia counsel. The court explained that appellant was not allowed to amend the notice of appeal to add the missing signature because the original petition was invalid under the rule, and thus there was nothing to amend. This court has applied that principle in many cases since then. For example, in Cohn versus Wilson, this court held that a complaint couldn't be amended to add the signature of counsel after the statute of limitations had expired, citing Wellmore. The court also held that in that case, that even if an amendment were allowed, it wouldn't relate back to the original filing, so that the original complaint, so the amendment was untimely. Additionally, in Scheidt versus Hunter, this court held that a complaint that contained the name of local counsel and the signature of local counsel, but the signature was signed by out-of-state counsel with the permission of local counsel. The court held that in that situation, the complaint was still invalid under Rule 1A:4. And moreover, the court held that the plaintiff couldn't amend the complaint under Virginia Code Section 8.01-271.1. Most recently, in 2011, this court in Landrum held that supplemental expert disclosure that was signed by out-of-state counsel and not local counsel was invalid under the rule and couldn't be amended. Now, appellant attempts to distinguish these cases, but their arguments are unpersuasive. Appellants argue that this case is different because local counsel's typewritten name appeared on the petition, but not his signature. That's not a meaningful difference, Your Honor, because the rules refer to the signature of local counsel. It doesn't refer to the typewritten name of local counsel. Moreover, in both Scheip and in Landrum, local counsel's name appeared on the filing that was at issue, but the court still held that the filing was ineffective because it didn't contain the signature of local counsel.
May I ask you this? When you say that we have no jurisdiction to address the motion to amend, are you referring to subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, I think so, Your Honor, because, and there's a discussion in some of the case law about active jurisdiction versus potential jurisdiction, but the Virginia cases say that the court's jurisdiction to hear appeals is statutory, and the statutes require that a petition for appeal must be filed within 3 months.
And do the statutes require the specific requirement of a signature of local counsel?
The statute doesn't talk about the signature. The Rule 1A4 talks about a signature of local counsel.
But the rule is promulgated by the court. How can the court expand or contract its own jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, the rules, I think, Your Honor, relate to what type of, when a filing is valid or invalid. So what Rule 1A4 provides that a filing is invalid if it does not contain the name or the signature of local counsel.
I follow you, but if the consequence of the invalidity is we lack subject matter jurisdiction, logically it means we have the power to expand or contract our own subject matter jurisdiction, which in common law would be thought of as quite anomalous.
I'm not sure I follow you. The way I see it, that the rule requires there to be a signature in order for a pleading to be valid. And if there's not a signature, then it's of no effect. And then there needs to be a valid petition for appeal in order for there to be jurisdiction. And that's my understanding of what this court held in Wellmore and the cases that follow it.
And I'm not really disagreeing with your interpretation. I'm just trying to unpack the logic behind Wellmore in some of these cases and determine if the jurisdiction we're talking about is truly subject matter jurisdiction or is it some other variety of jurisdiction.
I think, Your Honor, it's the jurisdiction that the General Assembly gives to this court to hear appeals. And the petition for appeal is necessary, a validly filed petition for appeal is necessary to invoke that jurisdiction in the same way that notice of appeal was required in the Wellmore case.
Can I ask a question? In the response to your motion, the appellants explained that the printing company took the PDF signature of out-of-state counsel and put it on the petition. Is it your position that if they had taken the PDF signature of Virginia counsel and put it on the petition, that that would still be insufficient, that it had to be a handwritten signature?
No, I'm not taking that position in this case. I don't think that issue is before the court as to whether a PDF version of local counsel's signature would be valid or not. Because that didn't happen here. The issue here is that it was pro hoc counsel signature that appeared on the petition, and that's the problem in this particular case.
Okay.
The counsel, that might be the problem in this particular case, but that's still an important question, because if the PDF signature of a valid Virginia attorney would be sufficient, then it narrows the issue. Do we have a problem here because it's both an out-of-state attorney and it's a PDF?
Well, we have a problem here because it's an out-of-state attorney.
Okay.
I'm not sure that whether it's a PDF or not a PDF is a material fact in this court. The appellant's response says that they intended to file a petition that had the typewritten signature with a /s/ of the local counsel's name. I'm not sure. I don't think that would have been a valid way to sign the petition. So I think what they intended to do wasn't in compliance with the rules either. But in this case, I don't think we have to get to any of those issues because the petition was signed by the pro hoc counsel instead of local counsel.
Okay. I guess I should direct these questions to appellant's counsel, but the intention was to have the /s signature, and the printing company said, gosh, they needed to have a signature, so they took the PDF and put it on?
I don't understand how it happened, Your Honor.
Okay, I'll ask appellant's counsel.
Thank you.
Well, in this day, moving towards more and more electronic filing, I'm wondering how it squares with our permissive filing with a clearly electronic signature when you're filing electronically. Now, I realize what the rule says, but I'm wondering if it's in some way is a head-on collision with what amounts to practices that are currently in place and are likely to be more and more the norm rather than the exception.
I think Your Honor's concern would be valid if this was an instance in which the defect that I was complaining about was a PDF signature versus a handwritten signature or something
of
that nature.
What your real case here is the out-of-state question, not the nature of the signature.
Exactly, Your Honor. And, you know, if If there were policy reasons to change Virginia law on this issue, I think the proper way to effect that change is for the General Assembly to enact a statute or this court to promulgate a rule that changes the current rules and the current law as interpreted by Wilmore and its progeny. But I also think there are valid policy reasons why the rule should be as it is. I'm running short of time. I wanted to reserve some of my time for a rebuttal, so I'd like to ask that the motion be...
Well, you have 12 seconds. I hope you speak very fast.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Isaac Howell. I represent the appellants. We filed a petition for appeal on March 9th, 2015. My signature was not included in that document. That error was my fault, and my fault alone. I apologize.
Can I ask you what you were intending to do? Were you intending to file it with the S signature?
Yes, Your Honor. I was intending to file it with the S signature. It was my understanding that such signatures were acceptable. I had filed other pleadings in the state court in that manner, and it had never been objected.
So the printing company was trying to help you out by putting in the PDF signature.
I think that they thought, yeah, they were trying to help me out, but then they removed my signature and the signature of Mr. Lovett, my colleague, and I think they were thinking, well, an S/ signature is not as good as a PDF image of the signature. We're going to help Mr. Howell out. We're going to put in a PDF signature of Mr. Glasser, who appears at the top of the list. They weren't thinking about licensure.
Did they even have your PDF signature?
I do not know that they had my
signature. Your directions to them were file this as is with everybody signing with the S.
That was my instruction was to file with a signature of each council, including my own.
But that's not a signature. I mean, you're saying the S slash.
I understand now where we are, that what I digitally submitted, you know, from Roanoke, what I submitted to the folks here in Richmond wasn't signed, nor was it signed by Mr. Glasser. And, right, they were trying to improve the product by putting the PDF image on there. And had it said Isaac Howell at the top of the list instead of Brian Glasser, I think they would have thought, well, Isaac's lead counsel, and we'll put his signature at the top, or get his PDF signature if we don't have it. But what happened was a list of S/ signatures, which again I don't uniformly do, but had done in the past and it had not been objected to. And this is simply the first time I've been here in this situation. So yes, I think they were very much in good faith trying to improve the product by putting not a handwritten signature, but a PDF image of who they understood to be lead counsel with no consideration of, I mean, it just wasn't on their mind who was West Virginia counsel and who was Virginia counsel.
Well, now that you've immersed yourself in the law of signatures and pleadings, I'm sure, what's your view on if they had put your PDF signature on that? Would that be okay?
I think that that complies with the letter of Rule 1A, which requires a signature. I understand that the court said in Scheidt, in a footnote, that the rules imply a handwritten signature must be there, but the word handwritten is not there in the rule. So, I mean, for me personally, it's, you know, blue ink, wet ink paper that goes to the court, regardless of what happens.
Your hand today, actually signing
with it. With my own hand, and that same piece of paper comes to this building with a blue pen. Obviously, I mean, this is this is not how I would choose to spend my first argument in front of this court to talk about a mistake of my own. But obviously, that's how I would handle it going forward. It is my understanding that many things are filed without a handwritten signature, with a picture of a PDF, even though Scheib says in the footnote that the rules imply that it must be handwritten.
Mr. Howell, let me say at the outset that I admire your candor. I'm not sure that you're entirely accurate, that it's all your fault. I think the printing company had a share of it as well. But let me say this. Here, it seems to me the issue in this case is not so much that. The issue is, does counsel have the obligation to actually read what is being filed with the court? And moving forward, as I understand the case, the work of the printing company was sent to your office and then filed by your office, or at least authorized to be filed by the printing company.
Sure. That's why I say that it was that it is my fault. The ultimate responsibility is mine. So I sent the document to the printing service. I didn't ask or instruct them to change the signature line. So what happened was they sent it back to me digitally. They made the changes that I was just talking to the court about. And I missed it. It was the day of filing. Their changes were primarily the cover, the table of authorities, the table of contents at the front end of the document. That doesn't excuse what I did, but I simply was not, my antenna were not up for changes in the signature because I didn't ask them to make the change, and they didn't say, hey, we made this change to try to help you out. Please make sure this is okay. That conversation just didn't happen. So they emailed me. I had the opportunity to change it. I didn't catch the change. It just wasn't discussed. And I said, I reviewed the cover. I reviewed the table of contents, the table of authorities. I authorized it to be filed by the, and then they printed it out and brought it, and filed it here with the court and, served it on.
May I ask you this?
Yes.
First, as the chief said, it's quite honorable for you to accept responsibility, and we respect that. But my question is, Wellmore appears to be quite clear in its holding. What is your best argument that Wellmore really should not be applied to your case?
Well, Wellmore does not. First of all, in Wellmore, they filed a notice of appeal that had no Virginia counsel on it at all. There was no indication, and the truth of the record, as the court said in that case, is that no licensed Virginia attorney did read that before it went into the court at all. There was a notice of appearance by a new Virginia counsel after the deadline had
That was gone. A fact in the case, but was it material to the analysis?
Well, I think that it was a fact underlying the analysis. I do recognize that the court in Wellmore said invalid, therefore nullity. But to answer your question, the authority comes from many places, not least of which is 271.1, which, as you were noting earlier, is a statutory, not a rule, it's a statutory provision. It says if there is no signature, then it should be cured, and then the pleading shall be stricken.
But that statute could be understood, as Wellmore seems to imply, to presuppose that the pleading that's being amended is not a nullity. The legal fiction of annulling the document is the logical predicate for saying the statute doesn't apply.
And I just don't find any language in 271.1 that says that defect renders it a nullity, at least in every case. This court has authority from 271.1. Inherent authority, Rule 1:8, Rule 1:9, the clerical error statute, all of which independently indicate that errors can be corrected, and that something that which otherwise would be a nullity can be validated by the court in its discretion. And that is true of 271.1, and there's no language that indicates to the contrary. And it's true of the rules themselves, the rules of court, that Rule 1:8 as to amendment, Rule 1:8 as to extensions of time, Rule 1:9 as to amendment, they all indicate that the court has that authority. And yes, if the court does not exercise its authority, then it's a nullity. The signature with my name on it did not come into the court until after the deadline. But this court has the authority. Albemarle Place's position hinges on the idea that this court does not have that authority. But that authority comes from numerous places, including a statute that deals with this very problem. And this court has allowed amendments, substantive amendments, to petitions for appeal. We are not requesting that. I am requesting
that. But you see that there's just a Venn diagram problem with the two arguments. Of course, courts amend and permit amendments to pleadings, but the presupposition is the pleading exists. By the moment a precedent says, no, actually, in the eyes of the law, the pleading doesn't even exist. It's a, quote, nullity. That's the disconnect between the two arguments that we're hearing. Is there any other way to reconcile those two paradigms of understanding this case?
Well, what comes to mind is that, you know, in Cohn, which was mentioned in Scheib, it dealt with a complaint and related back. And I think in the court was controlled by 8.01-6, which is a statutory limitation of when something is or is not a nullity. So I think that goes to your question, goes to the question of when is it a nullity that cannot be validated. And there's a statute about that for a complaint. Sorry, I was just looking at the phone.
No, you go ahead and answer the question.
Yes. However, there is no such statute or rule that limits the relation back of a petition for appeal. And I would say that answers your question. In certain cases, if you file a complaint and you want it to relate back, but it does not fit within 8.01-6, it's a nullity, it cannot be amended, and the plaintiff is out of luck for whatever defect there was that rendered it a nullity. However, there is no such statute. In fact, the statute that is most on point about this says there must be prompt correction upon notification. And as soon as Mr. Hicks called me, I hightailed it to Richmond as best as I could to get those signatures in place and before the court.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Code section 271.1 and the rule are consistent. They were consistently applied by this court in the Scheib and the Landrum case. I don't think there's any conflict between those. The court can apply both of them and prior to the dismissal of this case.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.